Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment I'll be joined by my old friend Lockwood Phillips. This week we're talking about gun control in America and Trump's Asian tour. I hope you find it interesting.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this afternoon. I'm looking forward to this conversation, a lot to chat about. And always with the opening of the program, we always like to invite Tom to share with us what's like the weather. What's the weather like in London, where he is situated? Tom, good evening to you. And tell us, what's happening with the weather there in London?
Cold and gray.
I assume this is seasonal?
Yep, we're coming into winter.
Okay, and what are we expecting this year?
It's black outside.
Well, yeah. And by the way, you have enjoyed a week longer of standard time than we here in the States. And I'm questioning, how is it received there in London? Do they get excited about having standard time versus daylight savings time?
Oh, or Londoners don't care so much. You know, this is done for the farmers.
Okay. But I still, it does interrupt everything, and commerce for that matter. But so now you're back to standard time, just as we are here in the States. So there's a five-hour difference between your time and my time. Of course, we're talking with Tom. He is, this portion is being pre-recorded because he is getting some sleep as we are airing this program. Tom, as we begin the program, of course, the first conversation or topic of conversations got to be the events in Texas, the Texas shooting. How has that been played there in the press in Europe?
It's been played fairly straight in the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go beyond the headlines, you know, they're a bit surprised by Trump's comments in Korea. And wow. The Guardian, I think, made an observation which has been made by most of the newspapers in one way or another, in which they compared and contrasted the way that Trump responded to the New York terrorist attack and the way he responded to the shootings in Las Vegas and in Texas. And with the terrorist attack in New York, they say, he responded to that immediately by calling for extreme vetting and the end of a diversity program.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't wait a second, just got the tweet out as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we had a shooting, a mass shooting in Las Vegas and then again in Texas, after Las Vegas, he said, well, it's not appropriate to say anything at this time. And after Texas, he said, well, we would have had more deaths if we had to have gun laws.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're drawing that distinction.
Well,
and the distinction is being drawn because they think that his supporters are gun supporters.
Well,
and they are not in any way supporters of immigration.
I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I think that you're looking at two different two different tracks. All right, real quickly, before we get on to other items, was there any discussion or topic related to the events leading up to the Texas shooting, such as the experience of the news that's been ongoing now for several days about the shooter himself being, well, number one, an atheist, two, having been dishonorably discharged from the Air Force and things of that nature and issues associated with his past, his violent past? Has there been any discussion of that in the media there?
It's all been reported. And also what's been reported is people saying, well, you know, if the Air Force had been honest about finding what they should have filed, that he would never have gotten the guns.
Well, I think that's a bit of a stretch to say.
The reaction to the European press is that, if the guns weren't there to buy, he couldn't have gotten them.
Well, the same holds true with vehicles. And if cars weren't available, they wouldn't be able to be used as weapons as well. All right. We gloss over that pretty obvious observation that so many people make, but the same time holds true with events of vehicular terrorism as well as airplane terrorism and other such things as that. All right. And then we're going to be watching, of course, with interest, the role that drones play. And by the way, has that topic ever come up in the media there in Europe and London the concerns related to the bad use of drones, the I'll use the word evil. Okay.
Yes, it has come up.
All right.
But drones are used here quite a bit. I don't think anyone's used them to, you know, they get worried about them being used around airports, of course.
Well, they are
used a lot to smuggle things into prisons.
Yeah, we've had the same situation here as well. All right, I want to move on. I just wanted to get that quick note on that one. Let's talk, since you are really focused and the media seems to be focused on the President of the United States, and we're going to get to other issues around other world leaders. Let's talk about Donald Trump's visit to Asia, particularly just recently Japan, now Vietnam, and China, as a matter of fact. Well, as a matter of fact, having just concluded a trip to South Korea. What is the coverage there? What's the opinion?
Well, fairly positive.
Really?
Yes, fairly positive. I've been reading the Japanese newspapers as well. The newspapers here were saying, you know, we note that he's toned down his rhetoric. Now, what they were looking at was his speech before the South Korean parliament, which they saw as, you know, a real thing to watch because he's in South Korea and we're talking about North Korea and he's talking before parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And again, comparing and contrasting with his speech before the UN. And, you know, they refer to the speech as being significantly toned down, that his Seoul speech was called more of a warning, while the UN speech was more of a call to war. And they also noted his offer to meet with Kim. And so they're quite, you know, I wouldn't say pleased. It's more or less, what I thought was an interesting story was one in the Japan Times, which had the headline, Asia learns to live with Trump rhetoric, but unease remains. And they described one Japanese teacher as saying that if Angela Merkel were U.S. president and said what Trump is saying, I would be very worried. But she isn't. Trump is. So I'm not.
Very interesting. So they kind of comprehend the bluster, if you will, that is typical of New York City. Real quick question. The visit to South Korea and, of course, the efforts to visit, the troops, which he did do. He enjoyed meals there. And, of course, the efforts to fly to the DMZ. How was that covered? The fact that he went and had meals with military personnel there, was that covered at all?
I think that was expected.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you
okay,
got
so it was covered.
There. No, I think it was very much expected. He didn't go to DMZ.
I know, but was it covered? I'm curious. Was it covered?
It was covered, but very straight. You know, nothing, no comment or anything like that. I think the other thing that was noted was the fact that both, Japan, South Korea, and China have really rolled out the red carpet for Donald. This is not an official visit. This is an official visit, but they're treating it as a state visit.
And so
there is a huge distinction. A state visit is an honor.
Right.
An official visit is to talk business.
And
the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the Japanese are treating it as a state visit, even though officially, it's an official visit.
And how is that being played again in the European press? Are they seeing this as something positive?
It's being played as very interesting on the part of the Asians.
Well, interesting,
they really feel they have to court the president.
Okay.
And they have to flatter him and try and, you know, win his support in order to get him either to accept their view of the world or to discuss things or whatever. That they're going for flattery in a big way. Now, when he gets to Vietnam and the Philippines, it's going to be different.
Well, it will
because he's not going there just on his own. He's going there to attend international meetings. Mm-hmm. And so they won't have the opportunity to give him the personal attention.
It will also be interesting to see how he and the president of the Philippines, Duterte, get along in light of the fact that they both have sometimes the same personality, very well, shall we say, brusque. The other aspect, and we're about to go to a break here with you, Tom, the reception in China, does this give anyone cause to think that maybe China will play a greater role with Kim Jong-un?
We don't know.
Okay.
I don't think anyone's speculating on that at the moment.
That's a legitimate
response. I think it was noted that Trump said recently that China is abiding by the UN sanctions, and he appreciates that.
Okay, so basically we're seeing this as a positive result of his trip. We're going to get back to that more here in just a moment, because I'm curious how the media is playing the entire issue of this coverage and what you've heard and read there, because we've had some interesting experiences here in the States. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, LookAhead Radio, with us this afternoon. As always, you're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com's expanded world analysis for the week being the 13th of November. LookAhead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. The British House of Commons starts the debate on the vital EU repeal bill on Tuesday. The bill is a central pillar in Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit strategy. Opposition parties have tabled more than 100 amendments, including one that would give Parliament the final say in the final agreement. The next round in Brexit talks will also be held next week, and the government will on Tuesday publish its plans for replacing a drop in trade with Europe with trade elsewhere in the world. The fate of Catalonia's president Carles Puigdemont is in the balance. He and four members of his cabinet have sought political asylum in Belgium, but the Madrid government wants him extradited back to Spain to face trial for sedition. The extradition hearing is on Thursday. There will be tough negotiations between the EU foreign ministers and the European Parliament next week over the EU budget for 2018. The Council has rejected the European Parliament's first plan, which called for total commitments to be increased to $165 billion and total payments to $150 billion. In France, President Emmanuel Macron will on Monday mark the second anniversary of the terrorist attack in Paris, which cost 130 lives in the Bataclan Theatre and the city's restaurants. On Saturday, Macron's Marché party will elect a new General Secretary and Executive Board. In the U.S., Attorney General Sessions will on Tuesday be grilled by the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee about his role in the Russian hacking scandal. Other congressional business next week includes committee hearings on U.S.-Cuban relations, the results of President Trump's Asian tour, and gun control. Mexico will host the next round of deadlocked NAFTA talks on Friday. Issues holding up an agreement include currency manipulation, protection for U.S. agriculture, rules of origin regulations, dispute resolution, procurement policies, and transnational investor policies. Kenya's Supreme Court is expected on Tuesday to rule on the controversial election of incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta, and there will be elections on Monday in Somaliland, which is broken away from Somalia. Chile is staging presidential, parliamentary, and local elections on Sunday. Incumbent President Michelle Bachelet is stepping down, and there are 8 candidates vying for her job. In Australia, the results of a plebiscite on gay marriage will be announced on Wednesday. At Christie's in New York, a rediscovered Leonardo da Vinci portrait of Jesus is expected to fetch a record $100 million, while an Andy Warhol religious work is likely to go for a mere $50 million. And that was next week's news today, so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned after this message for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints on the talk station, FM 107 AM 1240. With us this afternoon, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio, calling for this from London, where this program is being pre-recorded because he is now asleep, at least we hope he is, since there's a five-hour time difference. And Tom, we were chatting a few moments ago about the reaction to Trump's Asian tour, as President Trump's Asian tour. Quick note here, the media, how are they selling this or telling the story? We had an interesting experience here in the States related to one network, which quite frankly was believed in among the viewers that it was designed to, if you will, demean the president's actions, which interestingly enough, looking at the full view, compare very admirably with the president, President Abe, am I correct? Abe's
Prime Minister.
Prime Minister Abe's
actions. I mean, they both did the same thing. They both, right. In fact, I think Abe did it first. I think he tipped his food right into the the stream or whatever it was, pond. Trump followed suit, which is exactly what he should do. And it's odd. The Guardian is certainly not a Trump supporter. It's a left-wing newspaper. And it reported the CNN's gaffe.
Mm-hmm. Really?
So that gives you an idea of how it's being reported here. Now, this opens a whole question of the changing structure of the media, not just in the U.S., but around the world. I don't know if we have time to discuss it tonight because it's a very interesting topic. But basically, the Internet, instant communications, have changed the way in so many ways that the newspapers can act, react, and report.
Now, quick question for you, Tom. So we, of course, we're seeing this here in the States and as the United States, as a result of the growth of the Internet and also we're the nexus of much of the Internet development. I'm intrigued that it's being experienced as well there in the European press, because I know for years the European press seemed to work well, almost cordially with the digital media. Is it having a major impact?
Never did.
Oh.
It never did. I really think you got the wrong view there. The press here, numbers have been dropping. Circulation numbers have been dropping. I used to work for a chain of newspapers. The big newspaper there, two big newspapers were the Scotsman and the Western Mail, which covered all Wales. When I worked for them years ago, the Scotsman had a circulation of 150. Western Mail had a circulation of 120. Scotsman now has a circulation of 18,000.
Okay, so it's significant.
Has a circulation of about 20.
Now, with that said,
that just gives you an idea.
But with that said, does this also pose a challenge for the reporters in the sense that now somebody's looking over their shoulder and can, in essence, as we pointed out about CNN, if something is not told in its fullest nature, the reporters find themselves being judged.
When I was a young reporter and foreign editor for this chain of newspapers, I went in and complained to my editor about the fact that not enough foreign news coverage was getting into the papers I wrote for. And he looked at me, dagger's eyes. I mean, he was really angry. And he says, "Do you think we're a schoolroom? We exist for one purpose, to make money for our shareholders."
Right.
"And the sooner you learn that, the sooner you can do a decent job."
Well, I understand.
And that is the fact of life.
Yeah, it is. It is profit driven. All right. I find this interesting. You've made a note here, media cutting off noses to spite their faces. Real quickly, because I want to move on to other things. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the problem is that the media has basically backed itself into a corner because of falling circulations, falling profits and everything else, and the Internet. They've had to change their whole dynamics. They are no circulates in New York. It circulates to a liberal audience. The same with the Washington Post.
Right.
They're competing against people like Breitbart News and Fox News, who are not circulating to a geographic area anymore.
Their
global clientele of a particular viewpoint.
And
that's a big difference from, say, 30 years ago.
An ideology. That's a very interesting observation. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this afternoon. Tom, I've got to talk about an issue that, quite frankly, relates to the media. And that is now, I think they're calling it the Paradise Papers. And there's been a question, as a matter of fact, I was reading a Wall Street Journal article earlier today. The question is, who is behind this new disclosure? And of course, the Paradise Papers are related to, if you will, kind of a connection and expansion of the Panama Papers. They're describing offshore accounts for the very rich. And by the way, interestingly enough, we've noted, and I saw in the papers today, that not only has the Queen been challenged in this regard, apparently she has some offshore accounts, so Prince Charles as well. But others in various areas, not only government, but enterprise, private enterprise. How is that being played there again in Europe and particularly the United Kingdom?
It's a huge story here.
Really?
If I knew who was behind it, I could sell the story and make a fortune, but it's being kept secret. Someone has leaked the story to a German newspaper, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, and they in turn have sent leaks to, I think, 96 different other media operations, including the BBC and The Guardian. You're right. The Queen and Prince Charles have both been named as people who benefited from offshore accounts. It's not well known. The Queen has her own private estate. She also has money which is given to her by the government to fulfill her duties. Prince Charles has his own private estate. The Queen's is worth about $750 million. She basically has nothing to do with it. It's called the Duchy of Lancaster. So she personally gets the benefit of it, but she personally doesn't have much to do with it. She has 18 financial management consultants who work on it, and they basically screwed up. The result is that the leader of the Labour Party has called on the Queen to apologize.
For what?
Well, basically for investing in some rather dodgy companies who have in offshore accounts.
You know,
it's tax avoidance. Basically to apologize for tax avoidance.
Okay, that's the surprise.
Okay, the Commons Public Account Committee is threatening to call her financial up before the committee to testify. And there are some suggestions that the Queen should only be allowed to invest her money in the UK, which used to be the case up to the 1950s. But the return on the money was so poor that they allowed her to do whatever she felt was best.
Interesting. Of course, everyone else in the world is trying to avoid taxes, and then they challenge anybody who successfully does so. All right. Before we go to the break, what impact does this have on the royalty? And by the way, is there a growing populism out there that is opposed to folks being successful?
Yes, I think it's a direct result of the fact that people, their incomes have stagnated over the past 10 years or more. You see these very wealthy people getting richer and richer and richer, the gap widening, and the people in the middle classes or below, you know, they're getting worse and worse.
As a matter of fact, we're going to...
Mrs. Thatcher called it the politics of envy.
The politics of envy, that's exactly right. Or class politics, whichever. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this evening. What we're hearing from him is, well, something that's not unique to the United States or any other particular location in the world. We're going to get back to the very rich here in just a few moments. I want to talk about Saudi Arabia. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this evening. Again, this portion of the program has been pre-recorded to accommodate his sleeping schedule, and I can appreciate that. It's 5 hours later as this program airs here on the talk station. Tom, we were chatting a few moments ago about the issue of the Paradise Papers. And, you know, it's interesting. It's not getting a lot of coverage. It's noted here in the North U.S. press, but the other stories that are more pressing and more telling, of course, the Texas shooting, more discoveries there, as well as the president's visits to Asia and a few other items. But the one thing that is getting also, I think, shunted aside, the events in Saudi Arabia. I know we're going to talk about the missile attack here in just a few moments. But before we even do that, there's been a major, I'll use a word, purge in Saudi Arabia. And this is involving, quite frankly, some very rich members of the Saudi family who are, interestingly enough, big investors in U.S. and other world businesses. What is going on in Saudi Arabia? And what does this mean not only for the Saudi political scene, but for the economic scene? Tom?
Well, you know, the Crown Prince is fairly new in his job. That's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still consolidating his power. Basically, it's as simple as that. Now, so a lot of this is connected to Yemen, which people any royal family ticket could be Saudi Arabia's Vietnam.
Okay.
The Crown Prince, after the missile attack on Riyadh, on Riyadh International Airport, said this may be cause for war with Iran. Now, and was promptly backed up by Trump.
Okay, I want to get back to that. I want to get back to that in a moment. But first, I want to talk about the role of the Saudi family. You know, we don't.
Well,
really...
this was related.
Okay,
this was related because as soon, just to give you an idea, you'd think the government would be united about this. The foreign minister immediately attacked the Crown Prince for it.
Oh, really?
That's as an example of the divisions within the royal family and within the Saudi government.
This is the question: the Saudi government is really made up of small royalties. I say small, very rich royalties there in Saudi Arabia. This is an unusual country. How is it governed? Who establishes the king? Is it by popular effort? This is a very interesting and dynamic environment. One, of course, that is extremely wealthy. What's the future?
Do you remember the old Republican Democratic conventions back in the 60s and 70s?
Mm-hmm.
When basically everything was decided at the convention in the smoke-filled back rooms.
Right.
And that's what it's like in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
It's all decided back in the smoke-filled back rooms. And nobody really knows. It's a bit Byzantine. As to exactly how they come to conclusions, they don't actually chop each other's hands off or anything like that, but there's a lot of constant jockeying back and forth.
Well, the interesting thing is that several of the Saudi family have been arrested. Now, of course, they're living in a Ritz-Carlton where they have been confined. I say Ritz-Carlton, a Ritz, I'm not sure where. The question goes to, will there be some clear, will this very quietly go away, or will there be some major event? Could there be, quote, frankly, a civil war?
I don't know. I don't think there'll be a civil war.
Okay.
Unless they are completely defeated in Yemen.
Okay. And then let's talk about this battle in Yemen and the Iranian, the challenges that this was Iranian precipitated. What's going to happen now in the Middle East as Saudi Arabia and Iran begin to cross swords? Pardon the literal and figurative description of that. What does this mean for the Middle East?
The Middle East has a bit like it's a regional Cold War, like the U.S.-Soviet Cold War, but it's focused. But the main proponents or opponents here are Iran and Saudi Arabia, and others line up behind them.
Well, you've got Syria, Lebanon, you've got Iraq. What happens with all those countries?
Okay, in Iraq, that's at the moment allied with Iran. They've got a Shiite government in Iraq.
Oh, wow.
You've got a corridor of power going through Syria to Lebanon, where Hezbollah is trying to establish itself, and the government of Lebanon is trying to hold them off, and they're being backed by the Saudis. Okay, so that's that end of the Middle East. Down at the Persian Gulf, you have Qatar, which obviously, as we know, has been having fairly good relations with Iran and has broken off relations with Saudi Arabia and all of its backers. In Yemen is where it's sort of all centered at the moment. That is the cockpit. So you have all these other things happening around it, but where the fighting, the real heat of the battle is in Yemen. And there you have a group called the Houthis, which are Shiites, and so obviously they're backed by Iran. And they started a sort of civil war in 2011 when they managed to overthrow the government there, or started the process of overthrowing the government. And then in 2015... when it was clear that the government wasn't going to beat the Houthis, the Saudi Arabians got involved and intervened in Yemen. And now you have a proper war.
Okay, now
and the proxies are the Houthis and the officially recognized Yemen government. But the people behind them are the Saudis, who have also the U.S., the U.K. and France supplying logistical support, and countries like the UAE, and Jordan and Kuwait. And on the other side, you have Iran.
Okay, real quick question. I want to move on to other things. Tom, you mentioned Shia versus Sunni. Is this as much a religious dispute as it is a political dispute?
It's difficult to tell. I think there's always a, you know, the religion and politics are very mixed up in the Middle East.
Okay, I just was curious about that. Let's move on to another issue, and I'm curious what role might this next topic play in the issue in Saudi Arabia, if we can move quickly to this. You mentioned here Putin is tightening his grip before elections, and we've got mention of Russian mercenaries here. Of course, maybe the U.S. and other countries will be likewise trying to influence the Russian elections through the internet and social media. I say that tongue in cheek. So tell us what's happening in Russia.
Okay, well, relating it back to Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, the Russians are starting to use mercenaries in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East.
Where are they getting these mercenaries? Where are they coming from?
From Russia.
Okay.
And this is partly for the international community and partly for the Russian community. They have told both that there will be no Russian boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And officially, there aren't, because they're using private mercenaries.
Okay.
And what happens is the Russian government pays a recruiting company, mm-hmm. a mercenary company, and they go out and recruit people who work for them, not for the Russian government.
Right.
And then they send them off to Syria, where they become boots on the ground.
Okay, what role will this play in the Russian election, and when is the Russian election?
The Russian elections are in March, and I don't know. I don't think it'll play much of a role. Except the mercenaries are starting to be used in Russia as well.
Where?
Well, they're being used in Chechnya. They're being used in eastern Ukraine and places like that. I don't think it will get out. I don't think it'll be part of the Russian election simply because it's not being reported. Hmm. And the reason it's not being reported because media is now completely controlled by Putin.
But wait a second. We talked about this, and we've got to go to a break here in a few moments, so I don't want a long discussion on this, but I'm curious. What about the role of the internet and social media? Is that not playing? Is that not getting the information to
Putin has been taking lessons from the Chinese about how to set up a great firewall of Russia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's talk very quickly before I go to the break. Speaking of political events there, I've got to ask very quickly about the president, I hope I'm correct, of Catalonia. He has gone to Brussels. He has literally thrown himself to the mercy of the world court. What's the future of the division there in Spain with the Catalonian secession?
Well, as we speak, they're having a major general strike in Catalonia.
Mm-hmm.
Demonstrations all over the place. They've just started a few hours ago. Riots, demonstrations, everyone's gone on strike. And this is all related to the arrest of the cabinet ministers in the Catalonian government and the fact that Spain has imposed direct rule from Madrid.
What has this done for the world, what's this done for the European Union and the European community? Is this creating a sense of forbearance?
You asked me this last week.
Yeah.
The European Union is and will continue, as far as I know, treat this as a domestic dispute. It involves Spain. It's Spain's problem.
The thing I find interesting is while it's Spain's problem that the world court there in Brussels is going to be, if you will, arbitrating this this issue, possibly.
What do you mean? Well, I hadn't heard this.
I thought he had gone to the world court in Brussels to
the International Court of Justice.
Yes.
Have they agreed to take this on?
I have no idea. You're there. We're here.
I haven't seen this.
Okay.
I've been looking for it, and I couldn't see it. He may have tried to make an approach to them, but I can't see how the World International Court of Justice, they have to see grounds for their involvement.
Hmm. All right. Well, we've seen stories of this and have no idea what the outcome or if what the interest is. All right. It's just interesting in light of the fact that there has been this, and there is this still this tension between a more global approach versus nationalism in Europe. And of course, we've talked about this many times before. Tom, I want to move on to a few other items here as we wrap it up here. I want to look at the topic here of smog in Delhi, and you've got a note, a Modi slip-up. Very quickly, we've got about a minute and a half to go. What's taking place there in India?
The smog in Delhi is 30 times the approved rate by the World Health Organization for any other city.
Okay.
It is terrible. People are just pooping in the streets.
And what is the solution?
And this, I think, is a perfect case of, you know, a city which has grown too fast and without putting in place the infrastructures to deal with the growth. What's happening with Modi is he, you know, things like smog in Delhi are one thing, but of even greater importance is the fact that the economy, growth in the economy, has slipped from 9% a year about 12 months ago to 5% now.
Which is considered considerably higher than many other countries worldwide.
Yeah, no, but when you look at these things, you have to look in terms of, you know, what base are they starting from?
Okay.
You know, I mean, if the U.S. or U.K. grows at 3% a year, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. It's not overheating or anything else, but it has a very good established infrastructure. Whereas India doesn't.
Right. Okay.
And so it's expected to grow at a faster pace.
All right. That's a very good point. All right. I want to take a break on that one. We've got Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, LookAhead Radio with us this afternoon with viewpoints around the world. Just to remind you, you can subscribe to his blog, his newsletter, by simply going online at LookAheadNews.com, LookAheadNews.com. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from LookAheadNews.com. The world's media is rapidly changing, and as it changes, it plays a sad role in helping to divide society. The irony is that the press in all its forms has never been freer, more competitive, and offered a greater array of opinion and facts. The number of traditional print platforms has markedly declined, and the ones that remain are only just staying in business with slashed circulation figures. The print business, however, is being rapidly replaced with news websites. As of the start of this year, there were an estimated 100 million news websites worldwide. This compares to about 18,000 daily newspapers. To understand the impact of these figures, it is important to realize a basic truism about the vast majority of the media. It exists to make a profit. There are, of course, exceptions to this rule, such as state-owned broadcasters or magazines and newspapers published by pressure groups. The benefit of a profit-oriented media is that the profits keep the press free. Without profits, journalists quickly become mouthpieces for whomever is stumping up the cash to pay their bills. Alternatively, they become more outrageous in their news coverage in a desperate bid to maintain circulation figures. This is often as true of what is referred to as the mainstream media, quality or broadsheet newspapers, as it is of the tabloid scandal sheets. Desperate times induce desperate measures. Of course, it can be argued that the internet is also an opportunity for the traditional media. Before it came along, newspapers were restricted to how far their delivery vans could travel. The New York Times was sold mainly in the greater New York area. The New Indian Express didn't travel far beyond the boundaries of Chennai. And the Scotsman was read almost exclusively in Scotland. The World Wide Web provided a virtually free global distribution network. But who were the readers? This is an important question for newspaper editors. The identity of the readership determines the nature of the advertising and the direction of the editorial policy. Know thy reader is engraved on almost every editor's heart. Since 1851, the New York Times reader has been clearly identified as, first and foremost, a New Yorker. If the New York Times was going to succeed as a global product, it had to identify a new market to represent, and it had to rejig its editorial policies accordingly. It decided to become the world's liberal newspaper. It was an easy decision. The New York Times has a long history of espousing liberal causes, but it has become even more so, at times stridently so. The result is that their web circulation among the world's liberals has rapidly climbed, but they've been shunned by conservative-minded readers who had looked to the New York Times for a dispassionate report on the day's news. Previously, the conservatives turned a blind eye towards the paper's liberal bias. Its place in the media firmament made it required reading for all and sundry. But the internet, with its low entry threshold and global distribution, also enabled conservative websites to spring up to claim a conservative market which felt unrepresented. And the more outrageously conservative these sites were, the greater the attraction for their followers. Enter the fake news outlets. As of the start of this year, there were some 60 identifiable fake news websites in the U.S. alone. Almost all of them extreme right-wing. One of the most notorious is Alex Jones's InfoWars, which has claimed that millions voted illegally in the 2016 presidential elections, the mass shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School were a hoax, and that the Democratic Party was running a sex slave ring out of a Washington pizza restaurant. Justin Kohler, who owns several fake news websites, said, "When it comes to fake stuff, you really want it to be red meat. It doesn't have to be offensive. It doesn't have to be outrageous. It doesn't have to be anything other than giving them what they already wanted to hear." And that is one of the main reasons they believe it. They want to believe it. It reinforces preconceived fears and opinions, just as the increasingly liberal traditional press reinforces the beliefs of the liberal-minded market. It is not surprising that society is increasingly divided.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Coming up in just a moment, well, a little twist on the news in a few minutes. But first, Tom, I want to talk about one other item. We were chatting a few moments ago about the events in India and the fact that Delhi has one of the highest smog rates in the world, I guess, competing with some of the larger cities in China. Let's talk about environmental activists turned to the world's court. That's a topic we talked about a few moments ago. What exactly are we talking about here with environmentalists turning to the world's court? For what purpose? And, you know, what is this going to influence, Tom?
Well, now it's very interesting, this. What they're doing is they're trying to stop oil drilling and all sorts of things, and they're using the courts. Now, I know this is done all the time, as it's been done in Alaska and elsewhere, Dakota, but it's happening more outside the U.S. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is because over the past year or so, there have been more laws passed about environmental protection. Mm. And because the laws have been passed, people now have recourse to the courts. And so you're going to be seeing a lot more happening in the courts.
That being said, you've got countries, and I come back to Brexit all the time, but other countries as well that are not members of the European Union. What impact could this have?
We're not talking about European Union.
Okay.
We're not talking about European Court of Justice. For instance, there's a case now in Norway. There's another case, where is it? In Germany, I think, where there's a Peruvian who is suing a German electrical company because he says the German electrical company is responsible for the water levels rising at his hometown lake, and those levels are threatening to swamp the town.
Okay, a question for you. The jurisdiction on this court, does it have, I mean, how is that going to be, and very quickly, because I want to move on to the last item, how is this able to, how can they, what jurisdiction? I'm lost.
It has jurisdiction over the company because it's registered in Germany.
Okay, I got you. All right. Well, we've of course seen this here in the States as well. All right, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and LookAhead Radio. I want to move on to the final item and always enjoy this portion of the program with you, Tom. French croissant baker in trouble over butter shortage?
And guess what? Guess who's to blame? It's something you have in common with the second largest economy in the world. China and America are to blame for this.
Oh, I thought it was going to be President Trump. Okay, I'm surprised.
Well, it could be Trump.
Okay. How are China? How are the China?
Apparently, what's happening is butter has been cleared as good for you by so many doctors these days. They used to think it was very bad for you.
Right.
Now, thanks to Dr. Atkins and others, people in America are consuming about four times more butter than they used to. And in China, they're consuming masses of it, and they're also consuming French pastries, especially croissants. Mm-hmm. They become incredibly popular in China. And the result is that there's not enough butter in France. It's become so expensive for them to make croissants for their own population.
Okay, so there's
it's gone up fourfold in the last year.
Okay,
cost of butter.
So there's a butter futures out there, a future market for butters. I'm intrigued. We'll have to have that on the commodities exchange. I'm confident that would pose a great opportunity for folks.
Well, you're denying my French friends their croissants.
No. I'm just thinking there's a great opportunity to create a commodities market just on butter. All right. So the French are seeing an increase in cost. Anywhere else in the world that we're seeing a similar problem as a result of the new popularity of butter?
I should think it's everywhere.
Okay.
I mean, it's gone up internationally fourfold. But I think the fact is that there's so much butter in French cooking, especially in French pastries. I mean, they're at least 50% butter. And, you know, they taste delicious. They're terrible for you.
Now, wait a second. They're very good for you. Of course, we're talking to somebody who lives in London. And, of course, the British cuisine is, well, something to
famous.
Yes. Well, infamous is a better term. Tom, as always, thank you very much for being with us this evening. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. You can go online at LookAheadNews.com and sign on. Become a subscriber. Very easy to do. As always, Tom, thank you very much. Look forward to chatting with you next week.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Viewpoints around the world.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.